Hello and welcome to Inside Exercise. I'm Emeritus Professor Glenn McConnell from Victoria University in Australia, and I'm also currently a Danish Diabetes and Endocrine Academy visiting professor at the University of Copenhagen. The idea behind Inside Exercise is to bring to you the absolute who's who of exercise physiology, exercise metabolism, and exercise and health. And what I really want you to do is to get your information about exercise from the research experts rather than from influencers. And indeed, today I'm bringing to you Professor Karen Esser from the University of Florida, who is an absolute expert on circadian rhythms and exercise metabolism, exercise performance, what's the best time of day to exercise, etc. She has done a lot of groundbreaking research, especially around working out how much of the circadian rhythm is coming from your central, so the brain and melatonin, etc., versus the muscle. So she's knocked out genes in the muscle that control the clock. She's also looked at how the muscle circadian rhythm can affect other organs. We talk a lot about the effect of exercise on the muscle clocks, also the effect of the muscle clocks on exercise, the importance of eating at particular times of the day on muscle clocks, etc. I found it really interesting. I think you will too. So stick around. Hi, Karen. Thanks for coming on. How are you doing?
Hey, Glenn, I'm doing well. Thanks. And thanks for inviting me.
I've been looking forward to having you on. Not sure if you're aware, I should have probably pointed it out, but I did have Julian Zerath on a few months back talking about sort of circadian rhythms more to do with type 2 diabetes and exercise. So, people don't have to think, oh, okay, we've already talked about that. Because I think I've had about five people on talk about mitochondria and exercise. So there's a lot to talk about in these different aspects of exercise and metabolism and et cetera. So people know the interaction of exercise with muscle circadian clocks. So it's kind of like a two-way thing, yes? So does exercise affect the muscle circadian clocks, and do the muscle clocks affect exercise? Is that the way you're thinking?
Absolutely, both ways. I view the clock system and exercise as partners. I think it's in the muscle. Let me be very clear. So what I'm talking about here is, which obviously is different than the central clock.
Correct. And we'll talk about all that as well. But I always wonder how people got into exercise. It's funny, if you interviewed a cardiac surgeon, he wouldn't say, oh, did you get into cardiac surgery because you had a heart attack? But with exercise, quite often people got into exercise because they're interested in exercise. But, you know, other people were, you know, researchers, and then they moved into exercise. How was it for you?
A little of both, really. I mean, I was a math biology major as an undergraduate at Wake Forest University, but I was a field hockey player. So I was an athlete of some form. And it was one day going to the locker room, I met some people that were involved in a cardiac rehab program that was ongoing at Wake Forest. And I had an opportunity to volunteer as a student worker. I had a tremendous experience because I was basically an exercise test technician. So I went in there and I was trained to put ECG, 12 lead ECGs onto subjects that had come in for exercise testing. Had a great cardiologist there, a guy by the name of Henry Miller. So for those of a different generation, he's a past president of ACSM. And it was just very educational. And it really was like, wow, you can study physiology. I didn't know that. I mean, I didn't really get a sense for that. So I was a field hockey player. Had an opportunity to sort of get introduced to the fact you could actually do quantitative assessment of physiology on human subjects as an undergraduate. And that really sort of was the start of my kind of research career in exercise physiology, for sure. It included a stop for a master's degree. I worked with a guy by the name of Larry Golding. But it was more notorious because I lived out in Las Vegas for 2 years and had a chance to meet Arnold Schwarzenegger during that time.
Oh, you did?
And he picked me up. Anyway, that's another story. And
he picked you up, like physically?
He physically picked me up and put me over his head. Ultimately went to the University of Michigan to get my PhD and worked with Tim White on muscle regeneration, exercise, that kind of stuff.
Well, actually, funnily enough, I actually went to Arnold Schwarzenegger's childhood home in Austria.
Austria.
Yeah, we were traveling around. And we had a rented car, and it's like, oh, and it had his original bed still there and all that. And it's like, that's where he lay and dreamed about picking you up, I guess. Well, that's an interesting story, I guess,
yeah,
for another time. Okay, so why don't we talk about now talking about looking at muscle, I noticed we could maybe talk about it at the end, but, you know, we're going to be talking about your circadian rhythm stuff. But I saw you've just had a paper in Physiological Reviews as the last author on muscle
and hypertrophy.
Yeah, exactly. So that's pretty nice, because that's totally different. You're obviously driving that.
Well, that's where I started.
Well, not totally different, but.
When I first, I mean, I was not trained in circadian biology. That's sort of a very enjoyable scientific accident. We were actually studying hypertrophy in that time. And so, it was a real great opportunity. Mike Roberts, the first author on that, the other communicating author, had reached out to me to sort of relive some discussion of topics that we had worked on. And obviously some of the people that kind of were in my lab at different times, like Troy Hornberger, Gustavo Nader, and then my colleague, John McCarthy, all got to join in on the fun. So it had quite a nice list of authors. It was actually everybody chipped in. It's a great reference. It's fantastic in my mind.
Great Physiological Reviews. Well, I saw Stu Phillips was on there, and I've had Brad Schoenfeld on talking about hypertrophy. So I have to get you on to talk about that one day again. Okay. So if we talk about circadian rhythms, do you want to just tell people, what are circadian rhythms? You know, what are we even talking about here? And why do you think they're important?
Well, circadian rhythms actually are a part of biology and part of life on planet Earth. So circa diem is about a day, is sort of what that word comes from. And when we talk about circadian rhythms, what we're talking about are sort of we tend to use the word oscillations, changes in, you know, behavior, changes in metabolism, changes in biochemistry, molecular biology, that occur over about a day. And the critical part to define something as circadian is that you don't need light dark. Okay. So something that is circadian is intrinsic to the person, the plant. You know, obviously plants have rhythms, bugs have rhythms, all living things on planet Earth in large part have circadian rhythms. So this is something that's been with us on planet Earth.
So to clarify, when you say you don't need light of day, you mean if you just locked yourself in a totally pitch black room for 24 hours, you would still have that rhythm going on. So it's not,
absolutely,
even though light's important. Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. I mean, the very first recorded experiment in circadian rhythms was a monk about 1400, 1427, you know, and so many people may have experienced seeing leaves of plants sort of open and close, you know, so they're open when they
face the light. Yeah, exactly.
Right. And so all he did is he put it in a room with no change in light, and the leaves just opened and closed and opened and closed. So these behaviors are not a response to light dark. These are coming from within, not coming from without.
Oh, that's interesting. So thinking about plants, so, you know, I always think if you've got a plant next to the window, it leans towards the light during the day, and then it goes back again. Are you saying it would actually do that if the light wasn't there?
In large part. I mean, without knowing exactly what the plant is and all that, but yes, absolutely. and I mean, there's a whole field of research in that
That's
space.
Interesting. Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then people tend to think about shift work and jet lag and things like that. So, you know, I guess I was actually just talking to someone before about, you know, do you think circadian rhythms are important? A researcher here. And they said, well, when you fly somewhere, you feel crap, right? And that was their sort of, you know, I guess. And I guess what is that with it? Before we even get into technicalities there, what is happening with shift work? I guess it's because, with traveling. So you travel somewhere and you've still got that internal clock going, but you're walking around, you're eating, you're sleeping, everything's at the wrong time. So everything's out of whack. Is that the very simplistic way?
Absolutely. So jet lag is a quintessential experience of circadian rhythm disruption. or and some people might call it misalignment. So just, I mean, without getting too detailed, what you got to think about is every single cell of your body has a clock, all right? Mm-hmm. And those clocks adjust. And so when we travel somewhere, let's say, you know, so now we have a new light pattern, and that's then, well, this is going to get a little deep. So that information comes from the light in the brain, but then our clocks in our peripheral tissues, like for me, the muscle clocks or the liver clock or all these things, their adjustment to the new time zone is not exactly the same as the brain, right? So mm-hmm. so now you get the brain thinks it's, you know, 10 in the morning, the liver thinks it's 2 in the afternoon, and maybe the muscle thinks it's 4 in the afternoon. And so you're mm-hmm. just off. You're just yep. off. And mm-hmm. and that's what it feels like. And it just takes a while for yep. things to takes reconfigure and realign.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So why don't we talk about, because, you know, you've already touched on, you know, muscle clocks are what you're mainly going to be thinking about today. But why don't we just talk about the what's going on in terms of the circadian rhythm about a day with the light versus the peripheral sort of tissues. So, you know, you said the liver, the muscle. So, you know, the central, so, you know, the brain, the melatonin, things like that with light, et cetera, and then the periphery, how they're sort of talking to each other, just in normal physiology.
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, it's a great question, because actually the field is evolving and changing. So we're learning some new things. So what we know most about is that central clock in the brain. So that is located, for specifics, it's in the hypothalamus. It's referred to as the SCN. Not that important. Just think about the central clock. So the central clock, so in the clock, it's got this timer mechanism that is basically, you know, like your watch. It's counting minutes of the day in many ways. And that's just going to run. So now when the brain clock gets information from light exposure, it adjusts itself. It says, oh, okay, I'm going to, you know, go a few minutes this way, a few minutes that way, right? And classically, what was then believed for many years is that brain clock then sent information to the periphery, whether it's melatonin, whether it's through release of glucocorticoids, through the adrenal gland, whatever. And those signals would then align the periphery. That model it's not that simple. All right. So this idea that the brain clock through these neurohumoral factors is controlling the periphery is not wrong, but overly simple. Okay. Mm. And so the question you raise about how does this whole integrated system of clocks between the brain clock, the liver clock, the muscle clock, the heart clock, the guts, you know, all that kind of stuff has turned into be a network systems physiology question. So how are these things, how are these different organs talking? Who's got the loudest voice? And what are they listening to? Right. And so again, what is absolutely no doubt about it is the brain clock listens to light with the information that comes through the eyes and the retinohypothalamic tract. That's about the extent of my neuroscience there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. And so, but then how does the central clock coordinate the periphery? It's not clear. So what we've learned over the last 10 to 15 years is actually things like what time we eat, what time we exercise, that information from feeding and exercise based on when they're happening provides cues to our peripheral clocks to set them without changing the central clock. There is a term that's come up in the field called social jet lag. Mm-hmm. So this is, I always tell the students, if you've never experienced jet lag, you can create it at home. All you have to do is offset your cues. So if you just start with 3 cues, light, feeding, and exercise. Mm-hmm. If instead of consolidating them, let's say during your normal day, why don't you get your light? Obviously, you can't control light. Well, you can control lighting, obviously. So we can artificially do this. But now let's eat at, I don't know, 10 to 1 in the morning. Let's exercise in the middle of the night. What you're going to create is a system that is not all that different from jet lag. because your brain clock's going to stay with light. Different peripheral clocks will go with feeding. Different peripheral clocks will go with exercise. And so by spreading what I call, so I think of light, feeding, and exercise as environmental time cues. I'm sure there's more. So don't, I don't want to sound like we know it all, but those are ones that we feel pretty comfortable with. And so if we start messing with the timing of those, we can create a jet lag-like effect, which I'm sure no one really wants to experience, just by playing with our cues. And in many ways, our modern society has a bit of that already.
Yeah, well, you know, a couple of things I was thinking about there was, remember how we used to, with rodent studies, we just like grab them during the day and whack them on a treadmill. Gosh.
That's a and whole topic like, for me. That is.
I know it's like the worst, right? So that
yes,
and we wouldn't reverse the day.
Up at 2 a.m. and putting them on a treadmill.
Exactly.
And say, here you go.
Exactly. And there's your study. Like, oh, we're looking at the effect of training on this. It's like, well, actually, no, you're looking at circadian disruption, and you know, because you're messing with like you basically what you said then was you're messing with the peripheral clocks, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, because it's funny because. Sometimes you say, well, let's reverse the light-dark cycle, and sometimes you say, oh, let's not bother. And so the idea there, just so people know, is because mice and rats are nocturnal, you know, us being at work from 9 to 5 and then grabbing them on the, you know, sticking them on the treadmill when they're sleeping is not ideal. So what you do is you flip the light-dark cycle. So when you're at work, it's night for them, and that's when they're more active. But anyway, as you say, that's a whole other story. Now, just one interesting thing, because I do sort of go all over the place sometimes. Just occurred to me because I don't want to forget later. So when you fly overseas, then and then you go, oh, you know, this light's really bright because you're not used to it because you've just flown overseas and everything's back to front. So your central clock is sorting itself out. What are you going to do? Is whack on the sunglasses, right? But maybe it's just something I thought of.
That's fine.
You're probably
better
off not whacking on the sunglasses, right?
No. I mean, so this. I don't think so. I mean, I think the, you know, just for example, I mean, blind people, as long as they've got the right receptors in their eye, you don't have to see anything. You just have to get the light, right? And so that's why people talk a lot about, you know, for sleeping, keeping the room dark at night. And that, and it's not even, you know, even if you close your eyes, if the room is light enough, there's going to be a light leak. Right. So I don't really think the sunglasses is an issue.
Yeah. Cause you're definitely going to get a lot of light, even if you've got sunglasses.
You are. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So if we think about this, central versus peripheral. Yeah. So what about just melatonin? Because obviously people are aware of melatonin, they got sleep problems and all that. We can maybe talk about that later, whether people should be taking that, but so we didn't talk about melatonin, I guess, in terms of the central. So you're saying it's not maybe as important as people thought in terms of the periphery, but.
So one thing, I mean, so a couple of things, again, I largely work in mice. Now that said, so one of the things we do know is that, and rats, nocturnal, melatonin is a dark hormone. All right. And what I mean by that is I can be a diurnal human. And as I start going into night, my melatonin levels will change. I can be a nocturnal mouse. And as I start going from my sleep to my wake phase to the dark, melatonin levels will raise. So the response of melatonin toward the dark is similar in a nocturnal rodent as it is in a human. So the actions of melatonin are obviously different because you're not putting a mouse to sleep. and what its role, I mean, again, I think, I mean, I've taken melatonin. I mean, it is a hormone. It is associated with sleep onset. But its role peripherally in terms of clocks, it's unnecessary. Because the main model we use is the C50 is a mouse strain that doesn't have melatonin. It's missing the enzyme. So most of us, there are some people that have added melatonin back into the mouse line. It's again, it's not really clear. I mean, it's an important hormone, don't get me wrong, but its role in the circadian network is not really clear, and it doesn't seem to be a major player.
Okay. All right. So back to what you're saying earlier, that this idea that the central clock is regulating the peripheral clock is thought to be less likely now. So you're saying it's more diet, exercise, et cetera, that's affecting the peripheral clock. So why don't you tell us, therefore, what have you done? So you've been looking at muscle clocks a lot, and I know you've knocked out genes and things. So just tell us what you've done in your studies with muscle clocks, and what are you sort of finding? Which is a very broad question, I know, but yeah.
Yeah. And so I think, right. So when I first sort of, like I said, accidentally fell into this topic area, I was totally fascinated. And so the big question was, do muscle clocks work on their own? So there are a series of questions that we've pursued over the last, I don't know, number of years. You know, can muscle clocks function without a central clock? The answer is yes. Okay. What do muscle clocks do? And so this has probably been one of the things that we've been focused on significantly. And because again, as in talking to Julene, you know, obviously there's a very strong link between the clock and metabolism, but that's not the only thing. All right. So what is a clock doing? So the way I think about what a clock does, and the clock and muscle is doing this, is it is working inside the cell to regulate a daily pattern of gene expression, right? So what that means is there are a number of genes, number of proteins in our tissues that don't have, you know, that don't last for days and days and days. And so they have a job to do, and the timing of that job is temporally distributed. So the example I give is that, you know, just thinking about muscle when we think about activity or exercise. So when we look at what the genes that the clock are regulating and what time they're peaking, what we identify is that the muscle is preparing for oxidative metabolism before you wake up. Okay. So clocks are I think they're talked about as an anticipatory mechanism. So these are things that are working inside your cell to prepare the cell for what that next part of the day is going to look like.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So for muscle, you're going to be active, you're going to need fuel, you're going to, you know, that kind of stuff. So before you're awaking, or before the genes that are peaking are things related to carbohydrate metabolism, fat metabolism. Okay. You go through the day, you know, when you think about exercise, the other part you think about is you got to replenish your stores, glycogen, that kind of stuff, right? So that happens. So the genes that are involved in the storage part of metabolism are generally peaking in the later part of the day. So after your big meal, after you're getting ready to rest, not use, right? So you've got, so in a simple sense, the clock is kind of preparing your muscle to be active. And then before you actually go to sleep, it's already starting to work at storing stuff. Okay. And so that's what I mean by temporally distributing. So we always know that there's oxidative metabolism and storage, but the reality is these things are primed to be done slightly differently at different times of day, which is consistent with that. Okay. Now there's also indications that protein synthesis, protein degradation have time of day variances. We've been very interested in maintenance of the functional unit. So that the myosin actins, that stuff that generates force, the clock is playing a role with that as well. And the way I think about it is you want your sarcomeres, you want your force generating units in the muscle to be ready before you roll out of bed. And the reality is oxidative damage, mechanical damage, all kinds of things happen over the course of that active cycle. And you're more than likely going to be doing most of the repair and maintenance during the rest phase. Again, it kind of makes sense. You know, you're not going to repair your car while it's running. You're going to want to stop it, repair it, right?
And that's the importance of sleep as well. So that makes me think of, I read somewhere that amyloid, you know, which is produced in the brain and can play a role in Alzheimer's disease. It's cleared during the sleep phase. You know, so if you're not sleeping enough, maybe you don't clear enough, and then that maybe you get more Alzheimer's for that reason. You're saying the same thing, clearing up damaged parts of the cell or the whatever it is, it tends to happen when you're asleep. So again, if you're not sleeping enough, then that could be a problem. Now, in terms of what you said about you're revving up in the morning, so that makes sense.
Can I come back to that?
Oh, yeah, so better clarify that.
Yeah. It's not just the amount of sleep. It's actually, so what I want to make sure that everybody understands, the timing is important. I mean, yeah, you could get a nap in the middle of the day, but that's not going to help. I mean, the pattern of gene expression over that 24 hours doesn't change if you take a nap in the middle of the day. Okay. And so, you know, it's not just you sleep, you repair. It's really, you have a time of day that your muscle cells are primed to do this. So
the assumption is it's when it's nighttime, actually that makes me think of something else. I was thinking before we came on air, I said, because I'd set you some dot points and I was like laying in bed and I thought of these other things. One of them was before we had light bulbs and we used, you know, fire to have light to see where we were going and things. We obviously, I'm assuming we used to just go to sleep when it got dark. You know, maybe we'd chat for a little while, but we'd be in our cave. It would get dark, we'd go to sleep. It would get light, we'd get up. But now we're all, we haven't had time to evolve to this fact that we've got light bulbs and phones and all sorts of things going on. So we tend to not necessarily sleep based on the light cues. So I'm wondering about that. But then I thought, well, hang on a minute, because I'm in Copenhagen at the moment. And, you know, you might be getting 4 hours of like daylight in winter and like, you know, 15 hours in summer. So I'm just wondering, I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but what's going on? So that, I guess, you know, the cues and things are changing over the year, right?
Yeah, but I think, okay, so let me come back. So you're giving too much power to light and dark.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, so what we know is, you know, so the onset of, so if we think about sleep, so the clock plays a really important role in sleep onset. Okay. Now we have people, so I, for example, I'll just say I'm a morning person. I'll wake up well before the light comes on. That's just my intrinsic. And we now know that this is, so one would predict my clock is actually less than 24 hours. I maybe have a clock that runs about 23.5 or something like that. Mm-hmm. So each day I get, you know, there's a tendency to do that. There are other people like the colleague of mine in the department who is a night owl. And so he doesn't like getting up in the morning. He's not going to wake up when the light comes up. He's going to, I mean, if given his own opportunity, he will wake up when he wakes up and it's going to be after the light's up. And he will also stay up much later. And so I think there is a common, you know, so if you generalized across the whole population, it may fit some kind of light dark thing, but that really is the biology of the sleep onset and wake onset are really not light dark defined. I think that's an important concept, I think, in the circadian field.
Okay. So even though melatonin builds up during the evening and you're more likely want to go to sleep, it's I know it's variable because we did a night shift study, and I know people have as you say, different lengths and whatever. But anyway, why don't we, I've probably overdone it a bit with the central side. So back to the muscle. Yeah. So, okay. So you've done, like you've knocked out genes in the muscle and you've seen the effect. So basically, I guess you're saying that during the morning, you're sort of gearing up early in the day, gearing up for your for metabolism, because you're going to be ideally,
we're
meant to be exercising.
While
you're sleeping.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Right.
And then later.
I feel like we're getting some of these things. I want to make sure here, because there's some things that are getting a little, so the, like I said, the clock works to anticipate. So it's going to prepare the muscle cell when it's not high, generally speaking, when it's not highly active, to be ready for activity whenever that person, you know, gets active, and in contrast, it'll store before rest phase starts. So I think again, the melatonin is a hormone and it will impact on some of the sleep onset, but it is quite variable depending on the human, you know, in terms of its efficacy.
Okay. So I was starting to think, early in the day, you know, you're getting ready for your metabolism. Then later in the day, you're getting ready for storage, which is metabolism as well. But so then I was starting to think, okay, so based on that, people should perform better early in the day and not as good later in the day, because that's when they're getting ready for storage. But that's too simple, I guess. But why don't we start?
Got to shift that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So why don't we start thinking about that? So I know, you know, what is thought to be the best time of the day? So I know when I had Jolene on here, but that's more metabolism again. She said, you know, exercising in the morning. I think you may have been on, you were on a paper with Jolene with mitochondrial stuff as well. Yeah. But so the exercise in the morning, she said, was not ideal maybe for people with type 2 diabetes in terms of their glucose metabolism. Right. Versus exercise in the afternoon, maybe better. So I wonder if you've thought about that. I guess if we talk about metabolism maybe first in terms of time of day of exercise, and then maybe performance, if that's all right, sort of break it down a little bit.
So we actually have a manuscript currently in review. So if you give me a little room, because I'm going to talk about mice, obviously. Mm-hmm. But what has been really well established in mouse models is if you put them on a treadmill and have them run to do a maximum performance test on a treadmill, either in the morning or early in their active phase versus afternoon, late in the active phase, they perform much, much better, in the afternoon. It's just different labs, a group in Israel, a group in the US, variety. And then I had a postdoc that's like, I don't believe this. So he did it. And it's like, okay, it is. And again, being sort of exercise scientists, we went in and standardized it by treadmill work. So we used, you know, speed, grade, body weight of the animal. You know, it's a large difference in performance in the mice in the afternoon. And so what Stuart Heskus was the postdoc that did this work, what he did is he said, okay, I'm going to train them at these different times and see what happens. Do they still stay different? So again, you've got low performance in the morning, higher performance in the afternoon. So he's going to train them a group of mice 5 days per week in the morning, another group of mice, same, obviously, strain in the afternoon. And then at 3 weeks, he went in to just give them a max test, see how they're doing, and then adjust their training, because he was training them at 70% of their max. So again, and as an exercise person, you know what this means. This means those morning exercisers had lower performance. So 70% of their max is absolute levels less than those afternoon runners. So they're on the same relative exercise dose, but their absolute dose is going to be different. The ones in the afternoon are going to be doing more work. All right. So he trains them 5 days a week. We get to 3 weeks. He does the max test. There's still a difference. Afternoon runners are great. I mean, they both adjusted. So it's not like they're not adapting. Their performance improves. They both adapt. But the morning ones are still less than the afternoon ones. So he keeps going. Now the punchline here is he keeps going for three more weeks. We get to 6 weeks, there's absolutely no difference. So what we found is that actually those morning runners exhibited a greater performance adaptation than the afternoon runners over that 6 weeks, in spite of the fact they were working at a lower absolute workload.
Okay.
All right.
Because they caught up, you mean? Because they're lower to start with and they ended up the same. So they caught up, they had a greater absolute improvement. Yeah.
So their absolute was absolute. It was more. It was greater. Mm-hmm. And just there's no other way around it. And it's like, well, A, why didn't we see it at 3 weeks? B, how did this happen? And so we don't have a great. I mean, we don't. So what we do know from these mice is the clocks in the muscle in those morning runners shifted 5 hours over that 6 week training. All right. And so based on some work
later, so it was like they were running in the afternoon.
So if you take the clock and you advance it, right? So now when they're running in the morning, it maybe isn't the afternoon, but it's closer to what would have been.
It's getting closer.
Absolutely. And so based on some work that's been done both in humans and rats, there are time of day differences in maximal oxygen consumption rate of mitochondria from muscle. All right. So, and obviously, as again, with Julene's work and some others, there is a relationship between the clock and mitochondrial function. And so what we speculate in this paper is that by bringing the clock forward by 5 hours, what we've done is we've aligned the mitochondrial or the oxidative metabolism to be better linked with the time of performance.
Okay. All right. That's interesting.
But that process took over 3 weeks to get everything there. And so that's why we didn't see that difference at that point. So
a couple of things. That's really interesting. So a couple of things. First thing I thought of was maybe the ones that were exercising in the afternoon that were better, and they got to a point they plateaued, and then the morning ones caught up.
Again, we adjusted. We adjusted their workload.
Yeah, you kept adjusting. So, all right. Yeah. And then so you found the clocks
improving. Mm-hmm.
The morning ones shifted 5 hours later. Did the afternoon ones shift at all, or did they just stay there?
They shifted later, but not so. So yeah. Okay. So this is, again, goes back to exercise as a time cue.
Mm.
Now we're putting exercise in the afternoon. The clocks are going backwards.
Okay, so the assumption there, I guess, is that the body is thinking it's most efficient in the afternoon. So, but if you're running in the morning, it shifts to the afternoon to try and make it like the afternoon. Is that right?
This is one of those things where everybody has to find their way to understand it, because the way you framed it, I think, is correct. But it's like I don't
kind of weird, right?
Yes. So I think. The way I think about it is the clocks in our body, the clocks in our muscle, are very sensitive to the time at which we exercise.
Yeah.
And so again, it goes back to, if I'm going to perform, if I have a meet, I have a match, I have a race in the morning, I better darn well train
at the time.
If I'm going to be performing in the afternoon, I better train in the afternoon. So
yeah, exactly. All right. So assuming, I just want to clarify again. Okay, so you're saying that there's human data as well that supports this?
From the group in Maastricht. Mm-hmm. They did it's beautiful, actually. They did biopsies every 4 hours for 24 hours and took some muscle, did mitochondrial measures on that. It was published about, you're pushing me on this, I can't remember.
That's
but
right.
it,
so before 2020. Is it the same thing that they weren't as good in the morning and then they as the afternoon and then they shifted to later, or was it probably a bit different?
This wasn't a training study. It was just a study to look at the sort of the variation of, sort of probing circadian variation in human muscle metabolism.
And I know John Hawley looked at when records are set. I can't remember. Was it endurance? I can't remember, but it was mainly in the afternoon or the evening.
Mm-hmm. Strength is better in the afternoon as well.
Strength is better in the afternoon as well. Okay, so if you have an event that's in the morning, to try and make it as good as you would be in the afternoon, you need to train in the morning.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Okay, that's interesting, because I know that sometimes Julene was saying something about this, that the heats are in the morning, but the finals in the afternoon and all this sort of stuff. So it's like, okay, well, we need to train. Because I think the finals are usually in the afternoon, because that's when the crowd's up to watch them. Pardon?
Right. All right. I was just going to say, when it gets to elite athletes and they're training multiple times a day, to be honest with you, we don't know exactly how the clock responds to that. So that's the caveat in this. But we, if you're talking about someone that's training once a day, that's what we know.
All right. So exercise. So back to what we said at the start. So the clocks affect muscle, but also the muscle affects the clocks, because exercising in the morning is affecting the clocks. Yeah. So causing them to shift. So it's actually a nice design to see. You can kind of see both that way, can't you? That they're affecting each other in a way.
And we can do this actually in a dish. So we can grow muscle cells and we can make them exercise using electrical activity. And we can shift so what we have demonstrated, that was a Journal of Physiology paper, 2020, maybe 2021. Mm-hmm. Anyways, we were able to just sort of mimic exercise with muscle cells in the dish. So the muscle cells have the intrinsic capacity to sense the contraction, and that information goes to the clocks in those muscle cells to shift either forward or backward, depending on the time of day that the contraction happens. So again, but what that study was really important because it just demonstrated, A, you don't need motor neuron. You don't need a central, you don't need an integrated system. You don't need a central clock. You don't need hormones. There's nothing in that. It's just a dish with, media.
Okay. Because I was wondering early on when you said you don't need the central clock, I was wondering how you did that. Like, did you knock that out somehow in an animal? But you it's partly from the cell culture where all mm-hmm. you have is the muscle cells. So you can show that you don't need the central clock to get those changes.
Yeah, right. I mean, there's that. And then the observation that no matter with the time of training and the time of exercise, you can shift the muscle clock all kinds of ways. The central clock does not change. It is mm-hmm. seems mm-hmm. to be impervious to at time of exercise. I mean, that might be a little too strong, but it's
interesting.
In terms of phase shifting, it's not responding to time of exercise.
Okay. So that's exercise. Now the other one is the big cue is diet. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how does time of eating and doing things? I think you had something on restricted feeding mm-hmm. and the heart, I think I saw, but how does the time you eat affect your peripheral? So we're talking about the muscle, peripheral clocks.
Yeah. So the muscle is very sensitive to time of eating. And, in terms of cues between feeding and exercise, no one's done a head-to-head challenge. What's the muscle paying attention to more? So I can't answer that one. But time of feeding and what the specific cue from time of feeding is, we don't know. I don't think anybody has a good handle on whether it's circulating nutrients, glucose. There's some that have suggested insulin or IGF type signals. I, to be honest with you, I don't know where the state of the field is at that time. I do know that what time you eat can modulate the clocks in muscle. And so, and as well as liver and a variety of other peripheral tissues. And again, kind of like exercise, time of feeding does not seem to change the phase of the central clock. So the effects of feeding time are largely seen in the peripheral tissues, muscle included.
So, the social jet lag we touched on earlier, which is, mm-hmm. I think talking about, going to bed. So just say you normally go to bed at 10 p.m. then you mm-hmm. go to bed at 3 a.m. and it throws you out because you're active, between 10 and 3 and you're eating and you're probably drinking and who knows what else. But you're mm-hmm. saying that would not be affecting the central clock. That would all be periphery, throwing out your peripheral clocks mainly.
Well, I mean, once you put light exposure, then you've got central clock involvement. But if you have normal light exposure but start messing with your feeding and your exercise, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how long do these things take? So if you... because I know at one stage there was stuff on Twitter or something like people saying, oh, I can have, once a week, that's fine, to have a late night or whatever. Mm-hmm. Do you know how long it takes to start changing things? So if you were up late a few nights in a row, or is it just one night or,
I will say it's different when you're 20 than when you're 50.
That's true.
So, or 60 or older. Yeah. So there is absolutely, so there has been a significant amount of work in aging. So the ability of the clocks to adjust does unfortunately get slower with time, with age. So there used to be kind of an understanding that it takes about a day per hour. Okay. So in thinking about jet lag, if I'm going to travel to Copenhagen, that's about 6 hour change in time. So it would take approximately 6 days to get myself into alignment. Now, this is where things like, paying attention to your exercise schedule, your feeding schedule, that should work to shorten that. Mm. Or if you actually stayed on Florida time for my feeding and exercise schedule, that would be miserable. So the way I think about this now from a traveling perspective is that you want to harness your cues and you want to consolidate them. So wherever I end up, if I'm going to be there for more than a day, then I want to enter into that world and do an absolutely, even if it's just a walk, go for a walk, go for a swim, just get outside, do something, get some natural light, and then obviously some feeding. And alcohol is, unfortunately, it does impact clock function. So, again, one night, couple of nights, you know, we can all handle clock disruption. But it's, if you did it chronically, then that's when you'd start running into a problem.
Okay. Now, just back to this idea about, is it best to exercise in the morning or the afternoon? I've got a question here that ties in. You were saying, you know, there's different types of people, like night owls, et cetera. So there's a question, will sleep phenotype, i.e. whether someone is a morning or an evening type, influence whether someone would benefit more or less from exercise in the morning, midday, or evening? Mm-hmm. Or is there an interaction between exercise and circadian rhythm independent of sleep phenotype?
Yeah, so I would call that chronotype. There's a word called chronotype. And that's so what that person or what you are calling sleep phenotype is actually a chronotype. So we have, and that's what I was talking about. So you have your morning people, you have your evening people, and then everybody in between. And really what that means is we all have slightly different clocks. So like I said, because I'm a morning person, the prediction is, or I feel pretty comfortable saying my clock probably works less than 24 hours. So if our, you know, our environment is a largely 24 hour day, my clock is less than that, because I want to get up earlier each, you know, early in the morning. Now then, so my chronotype is that, and it's set by the sort of my clock period length. And then we have the night owls, who would have a clock slightly longer than 24 hours. And so they're having to adjust daily and would prefer to be getting up later each day, given the opportunity. So based on the concept of kind of the early morning versus the evening types, absolutely. I mean, so when I talk to people, I say, you know, what you have to think about is, what's my body clock doing? So if I'm thinking about sort of when's best for me, then I think about, okay, I'm a morning person. I mean, and again, as many of us always say, just exercise, please.
Exactly. Just exercise.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, that is fundamentally important. And the reality is, again, based on what we're learning from this other study, your clocks will adjust. So figure out where it fits in your schedule and do it and stick to a routine, because your body clocks are going to adjust to what you're doing, and you're good. You're good. Exactly. So I think, like I said, the time of day exercise really is more for people thinking about a race, competitions,
exactly.
Something like that.
Yeah, exactly. You wouldn't like not exercise because you're...
Oh, I missed it this morning. No, that's not a good excuse. Exactly.
Now, there's another question here. Is there a way to determine if somebody benefits more from training in the morning or in the afternoon / night? I guess you just see if you're better. Is it that easy? You just go down the track. I just can't imagine. I'm trying to think when I used to be a runner.
I
can't imagine that my intervals would be different, but maybe they would.
Well, I mean, so what I do know, so strength is actually a pretty interesting parameter. So whether you do grip strength, whether you do leg strength, whether you do arm strength, whether you're male or female, there have been about 25 to 30 papers published over the last 20 years. And they're all very, very consistent in that the population is stronger in the afternoon. And I mean, it's one of those things with human studies. And again, what I'm talking about is strength. I'm talking about maximum isometric strength. I don't want to get into the variables with power, with fatigue or any of that kind of stuff, because that gets more complicated. But in terms of muscle strength, you're stronger in the afternoon. So you actually could, and most people I know that lift in the afternoon. Funny that. So, you could try it. That's the one test I think you could try on yourself.
You could see. Okay.
Yeah. Now the response to training, response to training is messy, right? And so it takes how many weeks, then you get into all the things that I kind of watch on Twitter, but just volumes versus loads versus whatever. It tracking my own performance changes is a lot harder.
Okay. So I guess you don't know, therefore, that what you said earlier about the if you don't do as well in the morning, you end up catching up in the afternoon. You don't know that with the strength stuff, that even if you're weak in the morning, you end up.
The prediction is it would. So if I started doing strength training in the morning, I would imagine you'd see that shift. But that's to be tested.
My wife would be happy to know, because she's been going to the gym, and she always complains that she's not improving, but she's such an organized, she gets up in the morning, she goes to the gym, it's all done early in the morning. So I could tell her to try the afternoon. Maybe she'll get a bit of a breakthrough there.
Well, she's been training in the morning. The prediction would be no, because her clocks have already shifted over.
Say that. No, we need to, maybe it'll be
a placebo. Don't set her up for a disappointment. So
it may be a placebo. She'll suddenly go, oh, I'm 20% stronger.
She could try it and see what happens. That would be interesting to know.
Now, we haven't really talked about, we've touched on shift work. And I have to say, I did a study with shift work, and we found, I think it was quite a nice design, if I say so myself. What we thought was, let's try and make it, because, you know, when you do shift work, we know that people have increased risk of diabetes and cancer and all sorts of things. But you say, well, maybe part of it is because they don't sleep as much, you know, or maybe they eat differently. So we actually set it up so that they actually slept the same. But again, I'm just saying the same amount of hours. Don't know about the quality. We didn't measure that. But they did either awake at night or during the day. So we just flipped them. And we showed that even though they slept the same amount of hours and they ate the same and then their activity was the same, because we just got them to go out in the morning for a walk together, there was a reduction in their insulin sensitivity. Mm-hmm. So that was despite the amount of sleep. Now, but one thing which is interesting, I think, from that is what to do about it. So I feel really bad because I've been trying to think. I've got a colleague in Adelaide who's been finding that if you do shift work and you don't actually eat much during the shift, you can improve your outcomes. I don't know if you've heard about that. So this, again, tying together how important the diet and the exercise is, that I guess the fact that you've said there's peripheral clocks aren't expecting you to be eating during the night. So she's saying if you do shift work but you don't eat during the night, or you just have a snack, you have better outcomes. I'm not sure if you've heard about that or.
Well, I mean, it doesn't surprise me. I think that's great. I mean, because again, what eating in the night is going to do is going to create, it's going to talk to the clocks in the periphery and shift them, right? So for as long as you're doing that, you know, so let's say you're on a 3-day or 5-day shift. If you're eating during the night, you're telling your clocks, it's time to move. It's time to move. And again, some of the work that we did previously showed that when we disrupt the muscle clock or stop the muscle clock, insulin, those muscles become immediately insulin resistant. And a whole number of aspects of carbohydrate metabolism are very much under the control of the clock. And so components, let's say, enzymes of glycolysis, key enzymes regulating sort of pyruvate to acetyl coenzyme A, very much influenced by the clock. So once you start messing with the clock, you will affect things like glucose transporters, you'll affect flux through glycolysis. So as someone, and again, you know, so when I talk to people that think about a lot about type 2 diabetes, you know, it just muscle, as you are well aware, just messing with muscle insulin sensitivity has an impact on the system in terms of that.
So yeah, I guess, so what we did is we just had them either awake during the day or at night, and they were eating during the night and things. And the idea would be if they were not eating during the night, you know, I mean, it's not much fun. You're doing shift work and you don't eat. You would probably have less of a problem maybe with insulin sensitivity.
Yeah. You'd have less misalignment of the clocks. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. I feel like I'm looking at my dot points here. I feel like we've got through quite a lot of stuff. Can I ask you again? I know shift work isn't something you've necessarily looked at that much, but do you know the findings on which is worse? So I used to do shift work before I was an academic, and it was rotating shift.
Oh, God.
So 1 week would be day, the next would be midnight, so midnight till 8 in the morning. The next one would be afternoon, so 4 in the afternoon till midnight. But each week it rotated. And you'd be like happy sometimes because you'd go from day to midnight. So you had like a long, you know, you went from 4:30 Friday to like midnight Monday. But then which is worse, do you know, for the rotating or always being on the same shift?
I would say the rotating. I think, you know, because the way I think of it is, again, going to You've got this system of network of clocks in your body, and they're going to be better when they have a routine. And even so, while shift work is hard on all of it, if you have a constant routine shift work, that will be easier to find strategies to do better on. When you're sort of changing all the time, that's miserable.
So even though you have 1 week and three, which is kind of normal, mm-hmm. you're better off having kind of a weird like graveyard shift or whatever every week, midnight to 8 in the morning.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, I mean, there's still things to be learned here. So I don't want to be say that we absolutely know everything about this. But if you think, so let's say you have that week of normal. So then that 7 days, then if we use that hour a day, so that gives you some time to get your clocks aligned, but then you go down, you know, you start messing with them and throwing them all out of misalignment. So, and again, when you're younger, that's fine, but you know, middle-aged, older gets harder.
Now, I mean, this is a bit tricky. Nathan on Twitter asked, follow-up from that, how does shift work and rotating schedules influence how exercise should be programmed? So, yes, I'm glad you're answering.
Yeah, so I think, you know, it's sort of my best guess at that is you think about, I mean, again, it's going to depend on the shift, but and the kind of work you do. So if you're a real like physical laborer, you're kind of, your muscles during that shift are going to be, the clocks in those muscles are going to be adjusted just by the physical labor. All right. Now, if you're not, if it's a desk job, then one might think about, well, just keep exercising during your regular day period to try to keep things. I mean, so there are some strategies like that one can think about. I mean, if you think of exercise as a time cue for muscle largely, but it also affects things like white fat and lung and probably liver as well. So you know, just I would probably try to put my feeding and my exercise within the same window of time with if I was shift work.
So if you're on the same shift, so if you're doing this graveyard shift or something, would you're exercising at the same time? Would you suggest that you'd eventually shift so that time was sort of more optimal? So just say you're working midnight
for the muscles,
to 8 in the morning,
right? Right. Yeah. So let's say you're on the graveyard shift, right? So that would be something like an 11 to 7, right? Mm-hmm. So either exercise before you start, exercise after you finish, and keep that exercise pattern when you're on regular, you know, you're not working. So ideally, you try to keep those routines in place.
Okay. And just thinking again about diabetes, sorry, there's a thing I wanted to talk about earlier. They have disrupted circadian rhythms themselves. Sorry, you had a different term for it, misalignment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so do they have a misalignment per se? And if so, do we know what that's caused by?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, so when we think about type 2 diabetes, or actually a variety of different chronic diseases, the clocks are disrupted, but it's, I don't think misalignment is largely the issue. I think, so dampening. So there's also, so when we dampening. Think about these mm-hmm. clock functions, we think about, you know, when they peak, but we also think about the amplitude of that peak. And, right. So when we're looking at people with chronic diseases like type 2 diabetes, any disease that's got a chronic inflammation component, you see a damped amplitude. And when the amplitudes are damped, you know, the robustness of the signal and sort of the physiology downstream of the clock is less. And they're disrupted easier because they're not as strong.
That's the thing I remember now that Julian was saying, and I think you're both on the same paper. She looked at the mitochondrial transcription. So the gene changes over the day and the mm-hmm. oscillations, I think she said the peaks and the troughs were dampened in people with diabetes, which is exactly mm-hmm. what you're saying. Okay. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Do you think we've covered a lot of things we want to talk about, or is there anything you think we haven't chatted about that we should? And I don't know what your time's like either.
Yeah, it's
there was a question.
Some flexibility. So
what's that? Sorry.
It's Labor Day here, so I have flexibility.
Oh, sorry. So you're probably meant to be on holidays. There was actually one I saw on Twitter. You said good question. So maybe I'll ask this one. Ethan said, do scientists need to control? I think we know the answer to this, but anyway, do scientists need to control for the time of day in training studies to minimize training response variability, i.e. matching clock patterns to training time? Are there validated markers to use for this, or do we just say everyone trains at X time of day and be done with it?
Okay. So that's why I say it's a great question, because I think I would suggest the exercise field, especially those working in rodent models, need to pay attention to this. And there is some data that, you know, in terms of the translational relevance of the work that we do, we really shouldn't be waking up the rodents in the middle of their sleep and tossing, you know, putting them on a treadmill. Mm-hmm. And so thinking about reverse light cycle, but so to answer the question is, so A, pay attention to what time you collect for sure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Perform exercise interventions in the active part of the day for the rodent, so obviously in the dark. And to standardize, my suggestion is people take note, not so much of the time on the clock, but depending on, you know, your animal facility, if you're going to be doing, so let's say you put them on reverse light cycle, pay attention to when, what the time it lights off. Okay. So, mm-hmm. and then record, okay, I exercise them at 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours after lights off. All right. Mm-hmm. And that's something that all scientists can adhere to. It may be my animal facility has different hours, but I will know, I can standardize relative to that lights off period rather than just the time of day.
Yeah, there is, because there is a bit of a thing where people sort of say, oh, well, at least I'm reversing the light cycle. So I'm exercising during the dark, but they don't actually worry about it. It's the same time, which gets difficult, right. I guess, when you, because you're running animal after animal after animal, they're going to be different times, but as long as you match them within the groups.
Right. Just to give an example, so I've been involved in the big NIH consortium, it's called MotorPAC. Mm. So with Lori Goodyear and Sue Bardeen. And so we had to do a very large, these were rats, treadmill intervention. What we ran into, because we were doing such a large volume of rats over the day, what we went, once they started doing some of the informatic analysis, especially on the RNA data, was we didn't have enough controls to control for the time of day exercise. So we actually had to go back. And because they were seeing patterns that just didn't make sense. So, or it was hard to sort out what was time of day specific and what was exercise specific. So we had to go back and add in some more controls into that study. So the lesson from that is, yeah, you do have to pay attention to this. I mean, people have published, not my lab so much, but Julien has got a beautiful, I think it's a cell metabolism paper with Paolo Sasson Corsi. You know, you exercise animals at two different times a day, you get largely different gene expression patterns. Mm. And that's true in metabolomics. So the metabolomic output of the animal is very different. If you, you know, now if they're only 1 or 2 hours apart, not a problem. But when you're talking 6 to 8 hours apart, yes, there's going to be a difference. And so that would contribute. And you can imagine the same thing with humans as well.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. So, I mean, I guess we've all been doing that for many years now, that with humans, you try and do them the same sort of time of the day. Again, within, right. So I'm interested, you said within a couple of hours, you think it's generally okay?
I think that's fine. I mean, right. the clock is not a micro clock. It's a macro, it's a 24-hour clock. So, yeah.
All right. Now, I'd be interested in, you know, other organs. So, again, Michelle, and you've touched on, you know, we've talked about the liver and things like that. So, Michelle on Twitter, love to hear discussion about impact of exercise and muscle circadian clocks on other systems' circadian clocks. So, I don't know, is the muscle, you know, you have myokines that are released from muscle when it's contracting. Right. Are they actually talking to other organs, do you think? Is there crosstalk at the circadian level?
We think so. We don't know. No one's got any data on that, but that is an active area of research in the lab. I've got people very interested in that. What we do know is when we disrupt the muscle, so it's sort of the reverse, so not an exercise study. In our genetic mouse model in which we disrupt the muscle clock, we see profound effects on the clock in white fat, a little bit in the liver, but those are the only two organs we've looked at. So I think, again, this whole idea of what the muscle is doing to the system is an exciting new area. And whether the clocks in muscle actually can communicate with other clocks in the periphery, let's say, we will see. So
I wonder if anyone's done something like where you put, because I know that you said the cells, if you have cell culture, you can mm-hmm. see their rhythm. If you mm-hmm. put muscle cells in there that had a different rhythm, you know, you've trained mice or something from, you know, in the morning, and then you see how they go and they shift by 5 hours. And if you get their muscle cells out, you stick them in a dish with a hepatocyte or something, you know, like a liver cell. I wonder mm-hmm. if you can see any sort of chatting going on there.
There's a lot of really cool experiments to be done. So I think, you know, what you're saying is really interesting, because there are some ways to mimic some things in vitro to help inform us as we look, because in vivo models are obviously a lot more difficult and time consuming and expensive. So if we can trial some of these things out in vitro, that will be useful. And so, yeah, I mean, so what we've talked about, we can do this muscle contraction in vitro, just take the conditioned media, just pop it into another.
Exactly. Now, I saw you also had a paper on, it made me think about this, you had pro-inflammatory cytokines affect beta cell synchronicity. And I just thought about that because I listened to Jolene's podcast with me before mm-hmm. we chatted. And she was talking about how people with type 2 diabetes, there was an inflammatory response in muscle to a single bout of exercise. So I'm wondering if inflammation, I wonder if you have any thoughts on that. It's a bit incoherent.
Well, I have thoughts. I don't have a lot of data in that space. But the issue of inflammation, I think, is really interesting because historically, again, when I grew up in muscle physiology and such, you know, the inflammation side, those cells, that was just something else in the body. But that said, one of the things that we're seeing now that we're doing all these, you know, sort of RNA-seq studies what we're seeing is the category of inflammation comes up frequently with these clock disruptions. And so, for example, we have a manuscript currently under review in which we are taking a mouse that has no functional clock, and then we go in and rescue the clock only in skeletal muscle, all right? And we see some really profound effects. A, the mouse lives longer. So we've extended lifespan of these mice because they have the clockless mice have a short lifespan. So let me just, but we are absolutely impacting markers of inflammation in the lung, markers of inflammation in the white fat, and to some extent, some of the cytokine responses in the liver. And we haven't genetically modified those. All we've done is genetically modified the muscle. So there absolutely is communication between the healthy, what I'm going to call the healthy muscle with a clock and its influence on these other peripheral organs for sure. And through inflammatory markers.
Okay. And another tissue, which is obviously very important, is the heart. And I see you've got you've looked at heart cells, so the heart muscle cells, which are cardiomyocytes, and their clocks. Did you want to just talk a little bit about that? And I saw you had disruption of circadian rhythms triggers arrhythmias and sudden death in a certain type of mouse.
Right. So I have to give a lot of credit to my colleague, Brian Delisle at the University of Kentucky. So Brian is a cardiac arrhythmia specialist. So he's an ion channel, you know, looks at how the heart cells maintain rhythm and is very, there's a lot of data that, you know, so when is there is a time of day in heart attack association. So heart attacks have a tendency to be in the morning. Obviously not all of them, but the largest proportion of them, in terms of when people go to the emergency department or emergency room. So what Brian and I have been working on is, you know, so I'm kind of like came in as the clock person, and we can modify it genetically and do this. And what we've identified are there aspects of regulation of ion homeostasis that are under circadian control in these cardiomyocytes. So once you start disrupting the clock, you start making that heart cell more vulnerable to some kind of event that would induce an arrhythmia. And so, so his lab, and he's really been pushing, because he's in collaboration, but intellectually he's been driving this, is the impact of time of feeding on these features of the heart. And so we've got some papers coming out now in that space.
Okay. And what are you finding?
Is it, you start messing with the clock. It's not a good thing in this venue that you start with feeding. So if you're starting to, if you're eating during when you should be sort of resting, sleeping, then your heart cells are going to be more vulnerable to, some kind of trigger. And if you start with somebody, so in this case, we took mice that had a mutation that is found in the human population that makes them more susceptible to arrhythmias. And now you couple that with this altered feeding. And because mice normally have arrhythmias, so you have to kind of work hard to make them, but you give them that human mutation, you mess with their, so that already makes them a little bit more prone to arrhythmias. Now you start messing with the feeding, and it's a problem. I mean, you start seeing an increase in arrhythmogenesis. Brian gets into, sort of R waves, QRS complexes, that kind of stuff.
So if you've got a bit of a dodgy heart, and you're out late, don't get a kebab on the way home. Yeah,
exactly. There you go. There's as much as you may want it, please don't. Yes.
Yeah. All right. Now, another crosstalk one I saw you had was muscle and bone in terms of molecular clock. Did you want to just say a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, so there's been, that was really kind of driven by some colleagues after discussions, because it, obviously muscle and bone live right next to each other, and, communication is going on, should be going on, but we don't know much. So there aren't a lot of people studying the clocks in bone. I mean, that's a bit more difficult tissue to work with. But what we have seen is when we disrupt the clock in muscle, some of the factors that will affect extracellular matrix, interactions with the, different parts of the bone are absolutely affected. In one of our models in which we disrupt the clock in muscle, we get sort of, we get a calcification of the tendons, we get some changes in the bone. And so we don't know exactly who the players are, but it really did establish this communication between the two.
Okay, so for all of these things, whether it's the heart, the bone, et cetera, the takeaway would be, I guess, to have a normal day-night cycle. I know you said it's not just all day-night, but to sleep when you're meant to be sleeping, exercise when you're meant to be exercising. I mean, I'm sure most people don't get up and exercise at 3 a.m, but some people might get up and have a snack in the middle of the morning, or just stay up late. So it's not just, it's your heart health, potentially your bone, muscle interface, et cetera, are going to do better on average if you have a normal sort of regular sleep day exercise cycle. Yeah. And food cycle.
Absolutely.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay, great. All right. Now just one last thing, I guess we talked about age a little bit. Just you're saying that the clocks, just things aren't as good. Well, okay, maybe you can explain that clearly again. But also, I wanted to ask about if there's sex differences in any of this. I'm not sure if we did. Yeah.
So the question about sex differences is really we're learning is very important, and it's been limited in large part by costs of studies, right? So just like across all research fields. And so, but now with the circadian field, you've got, somewhere between 6 to 12 time points for any one group. If you have genetic differences, et cetera. So it expands quite a bit. We actually just did a circadian time course study looking at the heart, looking at males and females. And we're still in the analysis period, but there are profound differences. It's just... Yeah. Just even looking at the patterns. I mean, so the clocks run the same. They look, I mean, so you could take the network of the clock in the male and the female, and they pretty much overlap. But
this is
what
muscle,
the clock, pardon me?
This is muscle and muscle.
This is cardiac. This would be the heart.
Oh, sorry, in the heart. Sorry. Okay.
So we're doing this in muscle now. I just don't have the answers for that. But the expectation is the clockwork itself is exactly the same. But what happens downstream from the clock is quite different between males and females in the heart. The question will be, is that true in skeletal muscle? And hopefully we'll know in the next month.
And this is in mice, is it? Or
that's in mice. I do. So that raises a good point, because I frequently get asked about the difference between the diurnal human muscle and the nocturnal mouse muscle. Mm-hmm. And we have a review in obesity 2020, around 2020, or maybe before. So because a group has already identified, they did a muscle collection in humans, again, doing this sort of every 4 hours biopsy, sort of right leg, left leg, right leg, left leg. And they had about 10 people that were willing to do this. Mm-hmm. And they did a gene expression. And so what we did is we took our mouse data sets, overlaid it with the human data sets, but instead of, again, thinking about light and dark, we thought of rest activity cycle. And when we actually overlay based on active phase, rest phase, they look virtually identical. Okay. And so my understanding right now is the clock in my muscle looks very much like the clock in the mouse muscle in the lab. And obviously you can't do this with liver or a variety of other tissues. So we just sort of have to infer that this probably is very similar in the other tissues as well.
Okay, so that's fair enough. I mean, so you're looking at our day, because our activity is during the day and their activity is at night. And when you line them up, their night and our day, it looks very similar. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can ask for much more than that. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's good. All right, so I wonder if I can just ask what controversies there are in the field, because, is anyone going to be listening, like another researcher, and say, well, hang on a minute, is there any sort of controversies about anything we've talked about, or do you think it's all
pretty, I think there's a lot. I mean, I would say there's a lot of discussion trying to sort out the level of the central clock control of the periphery. I think that is so. Yeah. I have colleagues that disagree with me. So yeah, absolutely. It's not vicious or anything, but we're just like, well, I mean, the experiments are yet to be done, and so I think that's going to be really important.
And is it? I'm just guessing, because you came from a muscle background. Is it fair to say you might be the people that kind of came from a brain or a neuroscience background? Are they more tend to be the ones that think it's more central?
Yeah.
And you're absolutely more peripheral.
And I will. So I always joke with them. And I said, muscles are evolutionarily older. We have, there are animals that have muscles that don't have a central nervous system. So it's all meant, it's just like,
yeah, it's true. It's funny.
Let's stay open to what could be possible here.
All right, great. Well, this has been a great chat. How about we think about some sort of takeaway messages that you want people to get from this chat? So, when you give a talk or whatever, you think, as long as they remember these two or three things, is there a few things you want to take away?
Well, I think one, just know that there is this internal timer in your cells, in your muscle. And when you think about your own human health, think about taking care of your clocks, and that means your lifestyle choices. When you eat, when you exercise, when you, sleep. So that is all a part of healthcare now, and it's emerging very quickly. Thinking about if you are somebody interested in performance and competition, think about making sure that you're aligning your training with the time you're going to be competing. And then, for anybody else, just exercise when you can, and just understand that if as much as you can, try to have a regular training cycle. So if you tend to exercise in the morning, exercise in the morning. And again, it's not precision. It's not like 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock. It's just like exercise in the morning, exercise in the midday, exercise in the afternoon. Be consistent with that. And just, what we know now is the clocks in the muscle are learning from what time you're exercising, and they'll adjust the physiology to contribute to that. And so, and then if you do a lot of traveling, obviously, once you get in a new time zone, get outside, get light, eat, get activity. And again, the impact of exercise on the clock is really not a high threshold, at least at this point. We don't think this is high intensity exercise. I mean, this, you know, the stimulations we used in vitro, the kind of exercise we used with the mice was very moderate, and not really long. So we're not asking people to go do a 10-kilometer run or even high intensity interval. Do what you like to do, but don't worry about the intensity. Just get out and move.
Great. All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been fun. And okay, well, I'll see you around next time. See you.
Okay.
Thanks.
See you.
Bye. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please like, subscribe, pass it on to your friends and colleagues. Check out the other podcasts. Thanks again.